A book review. The name of the book, Finding Calcutta, What Mother Teresa Taught Me About Meaningful Work and Service. The author of the book is Mary Poplin, P-O-P-L-I-N. The book is put out by the IVP Books, and that is in Downers Grove, Illinois. This is put out in 2009. What do we know about this book? Well, let's take a look at the jacket, and the jacket will give us an idea. It reads, Lifelong educator Mary Poplin, after experiencing a newfound awakening to faith, sent a letter to Calcutta asking if she could visit Mother Teresa and volunteer with the Missionaries of Charity. She received a response saying, You are welcome to share in our work of love for the poorest of the poor. So, in the spring of 1996, Poplin spent 2 months as a volunteer in Calcutta. There she observed Mother Teresa's life of work and service to the poor, participating in the community's commitments to simplicity and mercy. Poplin's journey gives us an inside glimpse of one of the most influential lives of the 20th century and the lessons she continues to offer. Mother Teresa's unabashedly religious work stands in countercultural contrast to the limitations of our secular age, and Poplin soon discovered that God was calling her to the same kind of holistic service in her own Calcutta, the university world. No, not everybody can go to Calcutta, but all of us can find our own place of service and calling. Come. Answer the call to find your Calcutta. And we take a look at the table of contents to get an idea of what is in the book. And it's a long table of contents. So what I will do is I will just randomly go through some of the chapters. Chapter 1 is Getting There. Chapter 2, A Day in the Life of a Missionary of Charity. Chapter 10, The Vow of Obedience. Chapter 11, The Vow of Chastity. Chapter 12, Small Things with Great Love. Chapter 15, If We Say We Have No Sin, The Truth Is Not In Us. And that is a chapter that we will study. Chapter 16, Here's God's Grace. Here God's Grace Abounds More. And then we go on to chapter 26, Mother Teresa in the Body of Christ. Chapter 27, The Uniqueness of Christ. 28, Leaving Calcutta, 29, Finding Calcutta, and 30, My Thoughts Are Not Your Thoughts. And then there's an epilogue which reads, Fall More in Love with Jesus Every Day. Now let's move to that chapter, If We Say We Have No Sin, The Truth Is Not In Us. It's very profound, and I will read a section from it. Another infant lived at Shushi Bhavin. Perhaps 5 months old, with whom I was much less holy. He was badly deformed and always seemed miserable. Sister Joachim always appeared when it was time to feed him, and to tell the truth, in my heart, I was glad. Mary Poplin apparently was repulsed by this child, and this is why she was glad that Sister Joachim took over. Sister Joachim always appeared when it was time to feed him, and to tell the truth, in my heart, I was glad. She would draw him very close to her and look at him as though he were the most beautiful child in the world. She would speak to him and touch him as though he was returning her affection, but he never did. If he looked at you, it was always out of misery. When I was near him, I felt I was part of that misery. One day when feeding time was over, the babies were falling asleep in their bassinets, and I was getting ready to go. I had hung up my cotton apron and was collecting my water bottle from the top of a tall cabinet. I glanced at the infants as I started out and noticed that undigested formula was dripping from this child's bassinet. He had thrown up what must have been the entire 8-ounce bottle. Looking around quickly for someone to tell as I left, I saw no one in the infant area, and the few other adults in the room had their hands full with older children. So I decided, with little struggle, to stay and clean up the mess. I put on my apron again, lifted the child out of the bassinet, and held him on my shoulder as I began to gather the dirty sheets together and use them to wipe up the mess. As I was cleaning, I heard a muffled sound from the infant in my arm. Tears were pouring out of his eyes, and the only sound he could make was a convulsive sob. As I looked at him, I saw in myself what Jeremiah called the desperate wickedness of the heart. I realized I had approached this task with a spirit of resistance and impatience. I had thought very little, if at all, about this child and his needs other than to be clean. As I threw the sheets in the laundry pile, I began to bathe his little misshapen body and change his clothes. Afterward, I held him to me tightly as I had seen Sister Joachim do. I looked at him, rocked him, and prayed. I was given the grace in those moments to expect nothing, and I suddenly received something much greater. In a short time, he was asleep. With one arm, I found a new sheet, tucked it in the bassinet, and laid him down. In those moments, I saw this child for the first time as he really was, as the missionaries saw him, Jesus in the distressing disguise of a poor, lame, hurting child. I must tell you that the moment I saw him weeping and realized the wretchedness in my heart, I knew it was sin. There was no doubt in my mind that this is what Christ meant when he said, "Out of the heart come evil thoughts." I asked Christ to forgive and change me. In those moments as I rocked the baby, I could feel Christ work inside of my spirit just as surely as if he were sitting next to me. G.K. Chesterton remarked that sin is the most empirically provable principle of Christianity, a fact as practical as potatoes, he called it, and the single principle that causes many to avoid Christ. But with Christ, a way is made back to God and away from sin. Confession and forgiveness lead to the grace to love the not so lovable, a grace Mother Teresa and the missionaries exploited to the fullest. Sin is not a common expression these days, and just the mention of it can incite anger, even rage in people. Once I told this story to a group of teachers. For a moment there was silence, broken by a young radical woman who in a loud voice exclaimed that I had hurt her feelings. "Why are you using religious language? Tell us what you have to tell us without it," she exclaimed. And after she had gone on for a while, she paused. I pointed out that in the radical theories she had just professed, there is a principle which posits that no knowledge is neutral, and that the secular language she wanted to hear from me is not neutral either. I explained I had to tell stories about my own life as I saw them, else I would be lying to her. I am increasingly convinced that there is no such thing as the secular life. We are all religious in terms of what we believe, whether it is Christ or Marx. End of book review.